All right. Good afternoon, Sharon. You were very good on the cues there. Good afternoon to this month's support call through the Mainline Family Law Center, Preparing for Divorce. And we are really excited to have our guest on this call, and we realize that this month's topic, dealing with infidelity, is a challenging topic and yet a really important one for our audience. So we're, excited to be able to open a conversation about that, hopefully share some useful advice and some support around that, and help anyone who's on the line listening or listening in onto the recording later to be able to know how to get more support and information that can be useful in whatever situation you're going through at the time. So this is a monthly support call of the Mainline Family Law Center. The Mainline Family Law Center is a divorce and mediation firm designed to support partners in navigating all aspects of the divorce process in a way that allows them to emerge feeling healthy, whole, and empowered. This firm is unique in that it takes a holistic approach that includes support in all facets of the divorce process, including parenting, financial planning, and emotional support. And this monthly call is part of this the emotional support that they offer. It is in addition to many other services. My name is Adina Laver. I'm a divorce coach and affiliate of the Mainline Family Law Center, a newly founder of the new Divorce Essentials company that provides divorce coaching and support services for individuals, and we have a nice affiliate partnership together. So this month's call, as I said, is focusing on the topic of infidelity, and if you haven't had a chance yet to read it, in the follow-up email to this, Sharon can send another link to a blog article that we've put out. But statistics are very high in terms of, and we're going to hear more about this, in terms of the number of marriages that at some point cope with either emotional or physical infidelity, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And it can really create a great rift in trust in a relationship. And so we wanted to be able to really bring this to the surface today, have a little bit of sharing of information, some background about it, and coping mechanisms when this is something that arises. And we have today a guest with us who I'm really excited to have on. Her name is Judy Rader. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist with over 15 years of experience working with families, and her specialty area is really in helping couples and individuals work through issues like infidelity, communication, conflict resolution, and also relationship enhancement. And she also has expertise in parenting issues from working with young children through adolescence. And so I'm really excited that she is here with us. She to have a specialty area that does focus a considerable amount of her time and work in therapy around infidelity makes her truly an expert in this area. And so we're glad that she can join us and share some of that with us today. I'm going to try possibly something new today, which is an opportunity maybe for a little bit of interaction at the end. We'll see how that goes. And so I'll give you some indication when there might be an opportunity for a question or two for Judy or myself as we go. I'll give you some instructions about how to do that on the system. So I want to begin with opening this dialogue, Judy, and asking you first to give us a little bit more of an introduction to yourself and what you're hoping to bring to the table today through this conversation.
Well, you really covered my background quite well. I have been working in the field for over 15 years, as you said, and maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I kind of got pulled into the infidelity work just because I started to get a lot of clients coming to me that were having all different kinds of infidelity issues coming up, so just realized it had to be part of my focus. And I guess today I just, I'm very honored to be a part of your conversation and to try to help your callers and listeners to understand kind of just in a much more layered way, kind of warning signs, and certainly when an infidelity disclosure comes about, there's all kinds of emotions that are flying and rippling, and it's probably the most emotionally laden situation that can happen in a marriage. So just think this is a great opportunity to kind of give a broad background of all the issues that surround it.
Great, and that's exactly what we're going to do. So, Judy, let's launch right in. And the place I want to begin is really to begin by defining what we mean, because infidelity, we may have some traditional notions of what that means, but it's really become a topic that refers, as you said, it's multi-layered. It refers to a number of different things. So let's talk about what do we mean by infidelity, and generally, how frequently is this cropping up in marriages for people?
Okay, so traditionally, you're right. Traditionally, many have thought of infidelity simply in terms of physical infidelity, having a physical or sexual relationship with someone outside your marriage or dating relationship. And in fact, in early sessions, I'll often hear the accused partner say something like, nothing happened, or we didn't do anything, by which they're implying that there was no intercourse or not much physical contact, maybe. But infidelity also encompasses emotional infidelity, which is a situation where someone is regularly carving out time to spend talking or confiding in someone outside his or her primary relationship. And perhaps for me, the most useful definition of infidelity is the breaching of an emotional and/or physical relationship boundary. The nature of that boundary may vary somewhat from couple to couple, but the boundaries derive from explicit or implicit agreements that partners make about what is acceptable and unacceptable in their relationship. So a simple rule of thumb about whether you're crossing the line and entering into an infidelity is whether you would feel comfortable sharing with your partner the level of involvement you have with a person outside your primary committed relationship, including the activities, the time devoted, and the frequency of contact. So, for example, if the wife wouldn't feel comfortable telling her husband, my coworker Bob and I chatted on the phone 6 times today, probably for 2.5 hours total, about his job worries and his complaints about his wife. If she wouldn't feel comfortable being upfront with her husband about that level of involvement with her coworker, then we'd consider that she was involved in an emotional affair.
So, you know, I love that you made that distinction there and that you really gave us this sense that the emotional infidelity really can be as impactful as a physical infidelity, and that it really is this straying or this moving outside the boundaries of a relationship. One of the things that we also introduced in the blog article was the idea of virtual infidelity, which seems like it's a subcategory of really that emotional infidelity, that you may not be face-to-face with a person or even on the telephone, but maybe on the internet as well, and maybe, you know, there's a whole variety, whether it be Skype or through chat rooms or through other kinds of virtual medium, where we can also be having an emotional connection to somebody other than the primary partner. Are you seeing more of this crop up in your practice as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think the media, social media is really, really, you know, skyrocketing the numbers and occurrences of this. And when you think of it, if you're spending time on the internet, Skyping or chatting with somebody, and it's a regular occurrence, all that energy is being taken from your primary relationship. So it really doesn't matter if it's, you know, face-to-face in person or over the internet. It's still really considered taking energy and creativity and emotional closeness away from your primary relationship and diverting it to somebody else. So, yes.
Yeah, it's something, as I'm saying, come up a lot more too, and really difficult because it actually crosses or enters into both domains, I think, oftentimes of infidelity and sometimes addiction too, because it is so easy to become addicted to the online time. And so what I hear from clients is that it feels like both of those things going on at the same time.
Right. And here's an interesting, it's a generalization, but it, you know, overall holds true that generally men are much more triggered or affected by their spouse having a physical infidelity, and women are much more triggered by their husband having an emotional one. So it just kind of plays into how each gender typically leads with their closeness. Women tend to, you know, kind of lead with wanting emotional closeness. Men tend to want to lead more with physical closeness. So I guess the internet infidelities would you know, they would really probably be more along the emotional, which might trigger women more, although there's a lot of, you know, sexed stuff that's happening over the internet too. So it definitely is a huge area of infidelity that's going on now.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about how much is this occurring? How frequent is it? Because when it happens, when a partner discovers an instance or occurrence or what feels like infidelity going on in a relationship, it really doesn't matter how often it happens to anybody else. It matters that it's happening to them right then. But how often is this occurring? And you mentioned something before about what some of the warning signs are. That how often is this generally occurring in marriages as far as you're kind of seeing your understanding in this field? And what are some of the key warning signs that people can look for?
Okay.
Or may have already noticed?
The prevalence of infidelity is just such a hard thing to gauge, and it's really because people are so reluctant to admit it. So it really mostly is anecdotal for people from practice to practice, but you have to believe that it's really increasing with all the internet infidelity that's happening. So people have tried to gauge the prevalence of it. There was a University of Colorado survey a few years ago that surveyed about close to 5,000 people, and they got a significantly higher admission of infidelity by respondents that they surveyed anonymously than those that they surveyed in person. So there's all kinds of factors that go into really gauging, in the population at large, how prevalent it is. But just anecdotally in my practice, it just seems to be, each year I seem to be getting more and more cases, and I've talked to colleagues about it. It just anecdotally seems to be very prevalent.
So what are some of the warning signs? And then we'll get to, what is it really and why is it arousing in a relationship? But what are some of the warning signs? And our callers may either be feeling like they're noticing them in their lives, or they may already have noticed them and be somewhat further down the process here. But what are some of the things that typically arise?
Well, certainly, certain warning signs, which wouldn't have to mean an infidelity, but they very well could be, would be, people spending less time at home or more time on the internet. Obviously an increased amount of time devoted to however they're playing out the infidelity. So if you're noticing that your partner's behavior has changed in any way, just in terms of how attentive he is to you or how much time he's at home or on the internet, that would be one thing. Often you'll see if somebody has gotten involved with somebody else, you'll start to see self-improvement. Maybe they'll really start to lose weight and, maybe try a different hairstyle or, some behavior that seems like there's a sudden change in, their appearance or something. Again, it doesn't have to mean an infidelity, but they are certainly signs that often go along with it. I would say those are two major ones.
That's great, and I just want to insert something here for the caller's benefit too, is that when we use pronouns in this call, whether Judy or I may move into a he or a she, that really the statistics are that it's prevalent across both genders, and so nothing that we say implies that there is a single gender that is perhaps more guilty of infidelity or where the occurrence occurs, and actually you want to correct that word guilty, but just where there's an occurrence of it, because it is prevalent, whether it be same-sex marriages, whether it be heterosexual marriages and relationships, and on both sides of it, so that there isn't a categorization that this is only happening in one place.
Right, and certainly, whether you're a single person involved with a married person or that married person, you're both involved in an infidelity. And if you're talking about heterosexual infidelity, it's both genders. So there is infidelity both in also in same-sex relationships. But, yeah, we're definitely talking about both genders pretty equally.
Great. So now let's kind of get into the meat of what does it really mean when an infidelity arises? Because once it's detected in a relationship, this seems to be what gets the primary amount of attention. But tell us, what does it really mean when this is arising in a relationship?
Okay, so in my experience and in the literature, a very small fraction of infidelities arise from a partner feeling overly entitled. meaning from the stance of I love my partner, she or he is very good to me, but she or he's just not enough to satisfy me. The vast majority of infidelities occur in instances where the unfaithful partners actually feel somewhat vulnerable or worn down, where they feel that important physical and or emotional needs are not being met in their primary relationship. They've not found a way to advocate effectively to get those needs met, and they're not feeling able to easily leave the relationship, perhaps because of young children or financial issues. And so they become vulnerable to getting those needs met by another person who happens into their life and seems to offer the warmth, attentiveness, understanding, or whatever other qualities the partner felt he or she couldn't get in their primary relationship. And I'm in no way saying that the unfaithful partner is justified in responding to someone outside the marriage. I'm not saying it's okay, but just saying that some variation of that scenario is the story that usually emerges as to how the infidelity got started.
Which is a really important thing to, I think, really acknowledge that infidelity, that doesn't happen in a vacuum, that generally somebody doesn't wake up one day and just say, you know, I'm bored today, or, you know, I feel like going out and finding somebody else today, that it is something that happens and evolves over course of time, as you described, for any number of reasons. We could have an entire call on this, and probably we should, as to the different reasons why it may be difficult to communicate well with a partner over time as to what the needs are that are not being fulfilled, or how we're not meeting each other well, how life has taken a turn and is no longer providing something that feels important, whatever it is, that all those things, that it becomes difficult for couples to communicate, to find resolutions to those issues, and that those things build over time, which it sounds like leads to the cases of infidelity that you're describing.
Right. They often, you know, effectively kind of shut down on those needs. It's like, whatever, I guess I don't need that. I guess, you know, we don't have to spend time together, whatever. But, you know, those needs are very real, so you can only shut down on that for so long. And then if somebody enters into your life that suddenly confronts you with that warmth or that attention, it's like, you know, it just kind of blows up. It's like, yeah, I've been missing that. So, it's usually that somebody's not going out looking for an unfaithful partner. It's that they're very vulnerable, having shut down on a lot of important needs, and then somebody happens into their life that, you know, feels attracted to them or something, and is kind and warm or whatever, and it's kind of a step-by-step slippery slope.
Right. And so what are then, you know, when it happens, it of course is going to produce a reaction in a relationship. When it's discovered, it's going to produce a reaction in a relationship. And the discovery, I imagine, can come any number of ways, discovering emails, you know, picking up phone calls, messages, just, you know, asking about time spent in other places, those kinds of things. The discovery can happen in any number of ways. And then what happens once that discovery is made? What are some of the reactions that people have?
Okay, so the most common reaction to the disclosure of a partner's infidelity or the discovery is post-traumatic stress, meaning that the injured partner experiences some combination of flashbacks or intrusive thoughts, hypervigilance, racing thoughts, intense anxiety, and lots of difficulty eating, sleeping, focusing. Simply driving by a motel, whether or not the injured party knows for a fact that their unfaithful partner had sex with another in a motel, might trigger, you know, extreme anxiety. Hypervigilance often takes the form of the injured party rifling through their partner's briefcase or pocketbook, or scouring through emails or phone records in an attempt to get a clearer sense of the extent of the infidelity. And basically, discovering an infidelity shatters the injured partner's basic assumptions about their marriage or their primary relationship, including their beliefs about who their partner is as a person, his or her basic integrity, and the meaning of their committed relationship. And it's precisely because of such a basic understanding of such an important relationship being shattered that the injured partner is thrown into such emotional disarray. And that's why we really think of it as, you know, very much a traumatic experience.
Absolutely, and that trauma, you know, as you described, leads to any number of ways for anxiety to manifest itself, anger, hurt to manifest itself. And that initial period of shock that somebody has, you know, is there a way to say how long does that typically last for people, or what helps to, you know, start to move that on to another phase of reaction?
It's fascinating because I've dealt with so many couples, and it's just very interesting for me too, as I hear and listen to them, just to realize how many different experiences they have. I think the sooner that they can realize that the context of the relationship of their relationship was very troubled, so they're not responsible for their partner having an infidelity, but they can understand that their partner is not necessarily a monster who's just going out to hurt them, but who was struggling and, you know, who made a bad choice to try to address that struggle. But the sooner that we can get to there, the sooner some of that, you know, kind of outrage and, you know, just emotions flying all over the place, the sooner that settles down. We're actually trying to get out of the right brain amygdala into the left brain, that is kind of the smart brain that's willing to piece together a story and try to make sense of this. Some partners just really spend weeks and weeks just kind of venting, how could you do this? And, you know, I can't believe you did this. And they're kind of in that, they kind of stay in that outrage. And other partners can move a little bit more quickly to, I hate it, but I guess I can understand how it could have happened. And that's a lot of what the work of the therapy is, to try to move from kind of that raw emotion into an understanding, not necessarily saying it's okay, but just understanding, you know, how it could happen and trying to work through that.
Yeah, and we're going to move into, you know, what options are there. And before we do, I just want to say, you know, I want to speak for people who may be on the call who, you know, may be thinking, you know, you're kidding, right? You know, that it really does feel like a monster has betrayed them, or it really does feel like there isn't any forgiveness possible or even understanding possible, like let alone forgiveness. Let's not even go there. But there's been so much hurt. There's been so much, and that there's, you know, there is a lot of hurt. There is a lot of pain that's in this process. And, you know, that it just really, those feelings are really absolutely normal and absolutely to be expected. And, you know, for us to really just acknowledging here, as you've done, and just to continue that, to say these are absolutely real. There's so much hurt in there that it makes perfect sense to be having that reaction, and that the goal in our conversation is to think about, you know, what is the whole trajectory of this in order to be able to help couples and help an injured party to be able to move from a place where they are maybe consumed by anger and hurt into something else.
Right, exactly, right. There, just by the very nature of a betrayal, that absolutely, you know, throws people into those emotions that are very, very legitimate. You know, there were always other options, and if you went behind my back and you, you know, broke a vow, obviously anger and extreme hurt and anger are completely understandable.
So, you know, given that we've sort of set that stage here, is, you know, what are the options? So people are faced with this, and it's not true. We know that every marriage where there's been an infidelity ends in divorce. So, you know, once it's been discovered, once it's been named, what are the options that couples have from that point?
Right. So one option, of course, is always to end the relationship immediately, and some people, you know, do that. But the best option is usually to not decide to act on that too quickly, but rather to get into couples therapy and begin to process emotions, to get questions answered for the injured party, and then to decide once the rawness of emotions has dissipated a bit, whether you want to work through the pain of the betrayal with your partner. And, of course, your partner also must be willing to do that. Sometimes the offending partner wants to leave the relationship, so there's a lot to be sorted through. But if partners choose to work through the betrayal, it's important that the therapist help them to strengthen their connectedness of the relationship, essentially helping them to affair-proof the relationship for the future. excuse me, and this includes, among other things, teaching effective communication skills, conflict resolution skills, helping them learn to advocate more assertively for unmet needs and to raise gripes about relationships more constructively.
So I want to ask you this question. As you said, that, you know, the preferred option may be to pursue something to start to cope with and deal with what's happened and not to necessarily split right away. And I certainly want to chime in here as a divorce coach about this as well. But from your vantage point, what's the reason that perhaps moving right into a divorce very quickly may not be the best option for many people?
I think, again, because you're really working out of just raw emotions, it's more, you know, reactivity. I hate this. It can often be, it's just not your thoughtful self. And I just think over time, as emotions settle and as you begin to get a fuller story again, which would never condone the action, but might just provide some understanding of the vulnerability of your partner. Oftentimes people will regret that they didn't, you know, work harder to hold on to the goodness in the marriage. The other really interesting thing is that if people go through infidelity repair work with a good therapist, they're often much closer at the other end. It's hard for me to tell them that early in the process, but in so many ways, it's very hard to, you know, hear this if anyone that's listening is at all involved right now, but it can sometimes be a blessing in disguise because going through the work, the partner that injured, you know, the offending partner is working really hard to answer all the questions. He or she is experiencing a lot of shame and remorse, which can be very healing to the injured partner. And as they're beginning to do that work, they're really working as a team. So there's much more of a sense of togetherness. And then again, the next job is to really kind of maintain that and keep that going. So you often come out of this at the other end much more connected and, you know, much more of a team.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And for those who decide, you know, as you provided some insight in this option of people, if they, you know, do choose to work and see, is the marriage repairable, that even for those who may be convinced that it is not repairable or simply don't choose that, which is, you know, an acceptable choice as well if it's appropriate for this individual or for the couple, that I would endorse as a divorce coach your comment about waiting a little bit, and the reason would be that in the divorce process, when one pursues a divorce from a place of very heightened anger and a great deal of hurt, is that there's a tendency to see the divorce process as an opportunity to get payback, and it's what can lead to really messy divorces where children are often dragged through or people are doing things specifically to hurt each other, and the fact is that the courts don't really tend to respond well to that. Divorce is not a process that heals emotional wounds. It is a financial and contractual agreement that provides for the next phase of life for both people as they're moving out of a marriage relationship into another relationship. And what happens time and time again, as I talk to my attorney colleagues, is people spending money on petitioning the court or in trying to get things that won't really be supported by the legal process, but because they're angry and hurt, and really then it eats up financial resources for the couple. It tends to make the process take much longer. So for a couple or someone who just wants to end things and be able to move on, it actually prolongs the process.
Right.
But rather spending some time in really working with grieving and working with coping with the emotions that have arisen in a productive way will also make a divorce process be healthier for everybody involved if that's the choice.
Right. I agree with you completely. You're almost driven by your emotions if you don't kind of work them through and kind of gain some mastery over them. You know, if you process them, you can always speak from them. You know, I really am angry about this, and I feel that I need to advocate for this in a divorce procedure is much different than kind of the raging anger that happens when you haven't even kind of processed them through and worked through all angles of them.
And, you know, the things that you've described are, you know, really exactly true for people, and both as a therapist, you know, on the side of you're working through people through working with people through their emotions, perhaps working on with the couple, and as a divorce coach, I know working with individuals who are going through this, that spending that time really helps to shift the focus from that anger and hurt into the healing, and as you said, the restoration possibly. But if not the restoration of the marriage, the restoration of the individual, because
right.
both the offending party and the hurt party have lost part of themselves. They've really been damaged and wounded, and being able to restore and bring them back to a place of strength is important for both people and a family to be able to move forward, whether they're going to be moving together as a married family, married couple with a family, or separate individuals, and if there's children involved or other family members, for people to be able to move forward in a healthy way. And so getting those supports can be really critical. Let me ask you, in terms of the marriages that do recover and rebuild, it sounds like it would really be a very involved process and involve a lot of commitment. So how does that happen? You know, what is it that both people really are committing to do, and what would bring a couple to actually make that choice to try to repair their marriage after something like this has occurred?
Okay. Well, just in general, there's a greater chance that the marriage will recover from an infidelity if the affair were shorter rather than longer in duration, because there's something that can really be so, you know, upsetting and triggering to a partner who knows that they're unfaithful partner sustained it over, you know, long, long periods of time. So that's just a general anecdote. Also, the longer the marital relationship was and the more connected parents felt prior to the infidelity, the likelier partners will recover in general or might even just choose to work through it. So those are just two general statistics. But also how effectively the infidelity repair work is done in therapy is a big predictor of outcomes. For example, there's one very important step in infidelity recovery is the injured partner's ability to get all of his or her many, many questions answered following the disclosure. And many might wonder why it would be beneficial for the injured partner to find out exactly how many times his partner had sex during the affair, for example. But our nervous systems actually have less difficulty processing troubling information, for example, the number of times your partner had sex, than remaining in a perpetual state of not knowing what's what. Hence, the injured party's seemingly obsessive quest to relieve that state of not knowing. And so a lot of therapy is the therapist helping get whatever those questions are answered to, again, try to calm the nervous system. When the injured partner finally knows the full extent of what the infidelity was, they also blessedly know what it wasn't. And they now have a certain mastery over this previously emotionally unmanageable information. Their partner is no longer in a one-up position, having more information about the affair than they do, and the grieving process can now truly begin. So, you know, finding a therapist or counselor who can really help them and validate those questions, you know, that those questions are important, and if their partner is giving them answers that don't add up, to really validate that to the partner. You know, trust and healing can't happen until your partner finally knows that you're both on the same page, that you're both totally willing to be upfront with all facets of information. So it is a process, because in the beginning, the injured partner sometimes doesn't want to give the full story, and it's sometimes for, you know, reasons of not wanting to be shamed anymore, but it's also sometimes out of fear that if they gave more fuller answers, that their partner might, you know, get even more angry and leave. What I've found through all my work is it's really the opposite. Once they finally come clean, the partner may have a little bit more work having to, you know, kind of grieve and work through, you know, much more more information. Maybe it started sooner than they thought or something, but once they kind of, it really fits, okay, that makes sense, that I thought you were, you know, with her or with him that weekend that we were away on our vacation, you know, once it finally makes sense. I think the relief is that they finally feel that their partner is trustworthy now.
Right. You know, one of the things that we didn't talk a lot about before, but I think is an important thing to raise here is, you know, we haven't talked about children in this, and we haven't talked about what happens when either a child is the one who discovers the infidelity, or when, you know, how what role children play in this for people. So can you talk a little bit about what happens and how the dynamics are different? Should it be shared with children, meaning dependent children or adult children? What happens if a child is the one who actually makes the discovery or somehow just becomes aware that something is going on?
Right. Well, I think in general, you know, you don't want to bring kids into the process. So, you know, sometimes at the very beginning of a discovery, you might hear somebody say, you know, I'm so outraged, you know, your kids are going to, I'm going to tell everybody about this, you know, and that's, again, that raw emotion that you ideally don't want to act from that. Excuse me. So if the kids, you know, ideally the kids are, especially if they're young, are going to be left out of it. If the kids are picking up on a lot of tension, I certainly wouldn't give them details of an infidelity, but I might say, you know, daddy and I are, mom and I are having problems, but, you know, the reassurance, but we're working on it. You kids can relax and kind of be kids and, you know, we'll handle it and certainly keep it as much away from them. If the child does find out, I mean, it really depends on the age. It's best not to overwhelm them with information. So I would say depending on the child's age, if they find out about it, I might talk that over with a therapist because there's probably, you know, a million different variations on how to handle that. But secrets from children also cause them a lot of tension. So if they somehow found out some information and then details of it are being kept from them, again, they don't know kind of what it is and what it isn't, and that can cause them a lot of anxiety. So I think if they found out about it and they're pretty young and you're not sure how to proceed, I would run that by, you know, a trusted therapist.
Right, which seems like a good idea. Even, you know, I know in cases where there might be teenage children and things like that that are old enough to understand some things, but not the complexity necessarily of full relationships, but really recognizing that kids will need support as well and not to, as you said, overwhelm with information or details. And I also know it can be really difficult when a partner's feeling really angry or hurt and they don't, you know, they don't want this hurt for their child and their children, and they don't want their children with that partner, perhaps, because they don't trust them at the time. And all these things can lead to disclosures, but really for children, less information or taking great care with what information is disclosed and how children are talked to about it, if they have any information at all or they're sensing that discomfort, is a really important thing to take great care around and to get some support from a professional around.
And also really important also to think early on about how much you're going to spread it around with friends. I mean, if you have a trusted friend that you want to confide in, that's one thing. But if you're kind of out of revenge, you know, everyone's going to know about this, it's going to get back to the kids or the gossip or, you know, just information travels. So, yeah, again, that's why it's so important in the beginning of this to try to kind of take a deep breath in the long view. I know it's not easy, but to try to, you know, work through with a therapist or, you know, some really trusted friend just to kind of work through your emotions so they're not driving a kind of erratic, rash decisions about, you know, who to share this info with.
Right. So I want to ask kind of one last question as we're, you know, coming close to the end of our time here, but you know, one of the things that really comes up a lot is, one, how does anybody recover from the shame? Again, whether you were the injured party or you were the offending party, but even in addition to the shame, the trust. And, you know, I've seen people, how will I be able to trust somebody else? Because it really is a trauma, right? So how will I ever trust somebody else again, whether it be this partner or it be another partner? How do I know this won't happen to me again? So how do people navigate through that challenge of the will of overcoming the shame and the willingness to ever be trusting again?
Well, the shame certainly, you know, I, again, as a therapist, I would really you know, it's a process because you don't say it one time and they believe you. But they didn't do anything. So they are just the recipient of what happened. And if they're thinking, if the shame is because my partner, you know, I wasn't pretty enough or, you know, all those horrible, or I wasn't successful enough, didn't make enough money, you know, all that needs to be talked through. It's less about you and more about what was going on for the partner that, you know, they weren't able to bring their needs to you. And I mean, there's just a lot to that that I'd have to hear all the permutations of what goes into that shame. But the pain and the trust really comes from, if a couple's working this through, the person who committed the affair is really the healing agent, because as he or she begins to answer all the questions, they're really experiencing a lot of shame, which can be healing for the partner to see, you know, that, you know, God, I'm so sorry I did this and I don't know what I was thinking. And really the sharing and the working through and the carving out time to answer more questions and go back and kind of repeat the story to try to help the injured party get mastery over it. That's really the restitution. And again, it in time, what you'll see is it really feels like teamwork. And I'm really helping the person who had the affair to, like, I'll often say to them, I think it's going to be really important to you each day to go to your partner and ask them, how are they doing with the infidelity today? Kind of what's coming up, what kind of post-traumatic thoughts are coming up, and do they want to carve out some time to share them with you, so that you can help them answer more questions, gain, you know, a little bit more mastery over this. So it really becomes a teamwork thing, and they start to relate in a much closer way than they ever had. It's really quite beautiful to see. And the trust just comes in time. You know, you'll often hear over time, the person that had the affair saying, you know, I'm just so happy that we can, you know, be this close and that I can come to you now. And the other person is often saying, I recognize how distant we were. And so the trust just kind of comes as, you know, in the course of the work.
And I think you hit on one of the really key things here as we're kind of in our final moments here, is that all of this takes a lot of time.
Yes.
And healing takes time. Working through those initial raw emotions takes time. Thinking about what you really want for your future and making decisions not from a place of intense emotion, but really that takes your entire life, your family's entire life, your future into perspective, it all takes time. And, of course, when that hurt is first felt, it creates the need for some kind of an immediate reaction, an immediate dealing. And working one's way through this, working a couple's way through this, a family's way through this, takes time. And for people to be willing and able to give themselves and their families the gift of time to make the decision that's right for them, to make the decision, and whether that means working and restoring or whether that means bringing a separation to an ending to that marriage to allow new things in the future, but to give oneself and a family the gift of time to take it slow and to not make major decisions from heightened places of emotion.
Right. Right, exactly. So, again, that's why it's really very important to get into therapy with somebody who's kind of experienced it and can normalize that and can validate that, you know, I know you want it to be solved now and I understand that you want revenge right now, and that's all very normal. And let's see if we can slow it down, because, I've got the long view will tell you, you know, that I know you'll be much, much more relieved if you don't, you know, act in the moment. So it's just kind of normalizing the process. You're absolutely right, helping them to understand that, you know, it does have to take time, but they'll come out much more, you know, much stronger and more certain of, you know, their decisions.
Right, and in coaching, it becomes a really critical piece because if a couple or if one party decides that they do want divorce as an option, is that then the coaching is really supportive in being able to help separate out the emotional needs from the legal agreement that is actually being created. Because as we said earlier, the legal process is not an effective forum for really at carrying out or healing the wounds that were inflicted emotionally, and that process is really designed to support help coping with both pieces, navigating the legal process, while also supporting the emotional needs that somebody has as they're going through to keep them separate enough so that they're not interfering with one another and that the resolution on the end brings the best possible outcome for everybody involved. And so that kind of professional support in whichever direction a couple is choosing can really make the difference as to what the outcome will be, both for individuals and their ability to move on afterwards and for the health of a family in moving on afterwards. So I think, you know, Judy, I'm so grateful for the fact that we were able to have this conversation and be able to share this and hopefully bring people some both information and insight into the process and an opportunity to think about, you know, what they really want for themselves in here. And given all the information we covered, I was thinking we might open up for questions. I don't think we're going to be able to do that. But I do want people to know how to reach you after this if they'd like to explore any of this and also to know, you know, what kinds of work you do and where you might be in the community and things like that if people are in the Philadelphia area. So tell us a little bit how people can reach you if they're interested in connecting with you after this call and where they might find you around town.
Okay, well, thank you for that opportunity. I'm in Bryn Mawr at the Rosemont Plaza, 1062 Lancaster Avenue. I have a webpage, which is Judy Rader, JudyRader.com, and I actually have an infidelity article written there that I think is a takeoff, or yours is a takeoff, the one that you supplied on that. I'm actually going to be teaching at the Mainline School Night in a couple of weeks, a two-week, so two Tuesdays in a row, couple communication and conflict resolution workshop, which is always actually a lot of fun. But that is actually speaking to this issue of, you know, how we often shut down on our needs and don't advocate effectively for unmet needs or share gripes effectively. So it sounds like it could be heavy, but it's actually a lot of fun. But yeah, just if you go on my website, you'll see articles and a little bit more about me and get my phone number and be happy to speak with any of your listeners at any point if they wanted to reach out.
And is there, you know, if you were to think about books that might be available, articles or things like that, if people wanted to pick something up by reading, what would you recommend in addition to the article they will find on your website? But are there any resources that you would say, these are really helpful to people and I recommend them a lot, that you would like to share here?
Yeah, two of the ones that I think are most useful and pretty well-known are After the Affair by Janice Abrams-Spring. That's a paperback that's readily available, I'm sure, on Amazon and maybe even in Barnes & Noble. And then Not Just Friends, it's by Shirley Glass, and that's a very it's a work on infidelity.
Great, thanks. And I imagine people can find both of those through on Amazon or, you know, any of the booksellers like
right.
that. And so that's really helpful to people, you know, helpful to share with people so that people can find out where to go and where to read some more as they're coping with this process.
And they're both helpful both for, you know, both parties, the injured party and the affair party. So they really treat both ends of it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So I also, in wrapping up this call, want to let people know about what we're going to be talking about in November. And in November, we will be talking the second week of November. I believe it's November the 9th. And because we will be coming up on what is typically a holiday season in November and December for many people, and whether a couple is struggling or going through a divorce or on the other side of divorce, holiday times can be one of the most difficult times to cope with. And so we're really going to be dedicating the November call to thinking about the holidays and thinking about the choices and decisions that families can make that can really support a healthy, positive holiday season for everyone involved. In particular, we'll have a focus on children, families with children, whether they be young children or adult children, but grandchildren, and how that all those people are affected in the course of the holiday season. So we invite people on for the November call in order to listen in and maybe share some questions ahead of time that you have around coping with the holiday. And I also want to let people know how they can reach Mainline Family Law Center or me at Divorce Essentials, that if you are contemplating divorce and want to consider mediation as a process for doing that, you can log on to www.myhealthydivorce.com. It is an incredible resource of information there between articles and opportunities for consults and things like that. You'll see me there under the Divorce Coach, and anybody can contact me at either through the website at the myhealthydivorce.com website or at Adina, A-D-I-N-A, at Divorce Essentials, ENTIALS.net, and I'd be happy to take your calls and questions as well. So thank you, Judy, for being on. Thank you, Sharon, for helping out with our hosting this month, and I look forward to our listeners joining us again next month, and wish everybody a good rest of their day. Thanks for being on.